Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's January 26, 2022, and we are here for the third of our three scheduled oral arguments on Zoom.gov. Marshall, will you call the next case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Bryan, and Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding. Our next case is A211013. Catherine Dillard Rice Hayes, respondent, versus Augustus Conrad Thomas, appellant.
Good morning. As both of you may know, the way we're organizing our oral arguments on Zoom is very much the way we handle things in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask you to introduce yourself when you begin each part of your argument, because we make tape recordings available on our website. So we want listeners to be able to follow who is talking when. If you have any technical difficulties, let us know, because we'll stop and try and make sure we're able to correct them. We do want to hear from you. Finally, you'll see there's a clock in one of our Zoom corners, which has the time. So try and keep track of that, because time goes quickly during these arguments. And with that, is it Thruft?
It's pronounced Tuft, Your Honor, but however you say it is fine with me.
Mr. Tuft, we'll turn to you to begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices, and may it please the court. My name is Derek Tuft. That's spelled T as in Tom, H as in Harry, O as in Oliver, O as in Oliver, F as in Frank, T as in Tom. And I represent the appellant, Mr. Conrad Thomas, who is here and present. He's seated to my left. Your Honors, today we are asking that the court reverse and remand the district court's decision granting a harassment restraining order against Mr. Thomas and on behalf of Mr. Hayes, because the district court erroneously held that Mr. Thomas's actions and conduct constituted harassment. In order to find harassment, the district court must find reasonable grounds to believe that the respondent has engaged in harassment, and that's citing to Minnesota Statute 609.748, subdivision 5B3. Further, harassment has been defined as repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another, regardless of a relationship between the actor and the intended target. Further, the court has held that one incident of assault, sexual assault, or the dissemination of intimate private information may also rise to the level of harassment. Your Honors, under Minnesota law, the communications between Mr. Thomas to Mrs. Hayes do not threaten the safety, security, or privacy of Mr. Hayes and were never intended to do so. Further, Mr. Thomas's presence at Mrs. Hayes' residence on one single occasion also falls short of the statutory definition of harassment. Your Honors, I would cite to the case Beach v. Jeske, a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2002, as well as the case Murray v. Schaefer, also a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from June 11th of 2018. In Beach v. Gentsch, the court held that a single comment, while it might be unwanted, is not enough to meet the requirement of repeated incidents that may harm the petitioner. In Murray v. Schaefer, the court continued and stated that one single incident, even if it has an adverse effect on the safety of the petitioner, does not rise to the level of harassment under the definition of the statute.
But Mr. Seth, aren't we talking about a lot more than one single incident here? And I think one of the things that stood out to me, and so I'd really like you to address this, is your client, as I understand it acknowledged that he had gotten at least the text, maybe not the certified letter, but the text, saying that their relationship was over and that respondent did not want him to contact her. And yet he continued to send emails or texts. So it was more than just that one time showing up. So why isn't that enough to satisfy the statutory requirements?
And you're correct, Judge, on your reading of the law. It can either be a one-time incident or it can be numerous contacts, numerous actions that rise to the level of harassment. In looking at what rises to the level of harassment, when we're looking at numerous contacts, numerous communications, I rely on the case Dunham v. Rohr, a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2006, in which the court held that the statute before us requires a court to find that there are reasonable rather than merely subjective grounds to believe that the accused engaged in harassment. This case requires both objectively unreasonable conduct or the intent on the part of the harasser and an objectively reasonable belief on the part of the person subject to the harassing conduct. Your Honor, in this case, in this context, Mr. Conrad's actions, his conduct, the messages, the contacts were not objectively harassing. And further, Judge, I would argue that Mrs. Hayes had no objective reason to feel fear or to feel any sort of negative feelings from these. Your Honor, I would like to jump into the instant case here and discuss Mr. Thomas's actions.
Mr. Tuft, I'm sorry. Before you jump into the facts of the case, I am a little bit curious how you characterize what, even though the statute doesn't require an objective belief, it seems Dunham v. Rohr, I don't want to say amended the statute, it's a little too strong, but it seems the way we've applied Dunham v. Rohr is to include a requirement of objectivity. So the question I have is, do you characterize that finding as a finding of fact, or is that some kind of determination that would be subject to abuse of discretion? The finding that there was an objectively unreasonable conduct.
Your Honor, I would argue that goes back to the abuse of discretion standard. And we're arguing that the judge in the district court abused his discretion in finding that there was objective harassment or an objective fear on the part of Ms. Hayes. Your Honors, in the context of this case, we're looking at a relationship, a consensual relationship between two adults that lasted over 2 years. During this relationship, they broke up numerous times and they reunited numerous times. During these breakups, Mr. Thomas attended therapy, psychological counseling with Ms. Hayes. They exchanged letters. On one incident in a prior breakup that resulted in reunification, Mr. Thomas went through the steps of sending Ms. Hayes notes every day, little notes, funny notes, cute notes, things that we might consider inappropriate and strange. But the fact is, this resulted in the relationship being reunified, rekindled, and they became back together. This is a relationship where over 2 years, they broke up and reunited at least 4 or 5 times. And during the breakups, both parties were devastated. They were hurt. After a breakup, both parties would discuss how they got there, what they could do to change it, how things had gotten there. And ultimately, as I've already mentioned, it might seem strange, it might seem inappropriate to us, but the parties in this relationship regularly engaged in these types of discussions and in these types of communications. Your Honor, Your Honors, I would continue that both parties went to great lengths during these breakups, attending therapy, sending notes, numerous messages, phone calls, reaching out to each other. And that was normal in the context of that relationship. It resulted in at least 4 or 5 reunifications. What was different about this last one is that clearly Ms. Hayes had the intention of ending this. It was over. Now, the difference is that Mr. Thomas never got that indication. I'm going to talk about 4 specific facts here. And the one I would like to start with is the certified letter. The first time Mr. Thomas was aware of a certified letter was when he was served with the HRO petition. He had never received a certified letter, didn't know about it. And in the district court, we provided evidence to show from the USPS that he had never received the letter. It was stuck in transit. Once Mr. Thomas received that letter, he indicated, "I can't believe it went this far. I never meant for it to go this far, and I can't believe she's afraid of me." At that point, he understood it was done. Up until that point, there was no indication that this was over and there was no chance to reunite. Another fact that I would like to briefly touch on is the scrapbook. Opposing counsel has insinuated that in some way this was an attempt to disseminate private information, an attempt to get out intimate details of the relationship. And that could not be further from the truth. In fact, this scrapbook mimics the notes and the letters that Mr. Thomas had sent to Ms. Hayes in past breakups. There was never an attempt to disseminate this information to anyone other than the two parties. This information was never made public. It was never published. It was never sent to anyone other than Ms. Hayes. The third fact that I would like to briefly touch on and visit is Mr. Thomas's visit to Mrs. Hayes' house. Clearly, from the record, Mrs. Hayes was uncomfortable with this, but I would like to talk about it. This was not a prohibited visit. This was not a visit that had been discussed, and Mr. Thomas knew he was crossing the line. He had had no discussion with
Mrs. Hayes. I can just ask, wasn't the visit after he received that text message I referred to earlier, which he admitted he received, where she said she wanted no further contact with him?
That's correct, Your Honor. The visit was after the text message. And in discussing it with Mr. Thomas, this was a last attempt for him to put closure on this relationship. He wanted to, based on the history and how many times they had broken up and reunited, see if this was done for real and get some closure so that he could move on with his life.
Counselor, you earlier urged us to look at what was objectively harassment. I mean, and you're saying to us, look, it may be inappropriate to us, but it wasn't in the context of that relationship. But isn't that what we should be looking at, is whether there's an abuse of discretion for the district court to find that this was objectively harassment?
And Judge, I would cite to Beach versus Jenschke and Murray versus Schaefer, where the court has held that a single incident, although it may not be condoned, although it may be inappropriate, is not enough to rise to the level of harassment. Your Honor, I would also like to jump into what happened here. Mr. Thomas showed up to the house with flowers. He knocked on the door. He wasn't sneaking around. He wasn't trying to obtain information. He knocked on the door and Ms. Hayes let him into the house. He gave her the flowers and he asked her, are we done? Where's this going? I'm hurt. I'm sad. I want to know if, you know, this is over. And once Mr. Thomas realized that the situation was uncomfortable, he didn't have to wait for the police to be called. He didn't have to wait to be asked to leave. There was no yelling. There was no swearing. He realized it was uncomfortable. He saw himself out and he ended the conversation. Nothing threatening happened here. Nothing that would be considered reasonably to cause fear occurred in this visit. It was a simple visit to the house that was not discussed prior. Had it been discussed prior, he would not have been there. And once he understood that it was not welcome, he left. He saw himself out. Finally, judges, I would like to visit one last fact, and that is the fact that there are numerous communications here. Mr. Thomas continued to send emails, continued to send social media contacts, continued to call. What I would like to point out is the substance of these text messages. They were not angry. They were not threatening. They do not show some kind of mental issue or threat. In no way were any of these communications geared towards causing fear, uncomfort, or any negative feelings in Ms. Hayes. The purpose of the communications in the context of a relationship that had lasted 2 years with numerous breakups and numerous rekindlings was simply a heartbroken man trying to figure out where he goes from here. This isn't somebody who is threatening Ms. Hayes, who is a danger to Ms. Hayes. This is a normal man who, albeit strangely and maybe inappropriately, wanted to move on with his life.
So, Mr. Tuft, I'd like to hear from you. At what point does that behavior cross the line then from just merely being annoying, as you've suggested in your brief, to being objectively harassing, especially in light of the number of contacts that were made? And I'm wondering if you can speak to the fact that perhaps even just the volume of contacts that were made without a positive response or with a direct rejection to the initiation of that contact, whether that is a factor we should consider.
Certainly, Judge. And to that point, I would state it's a two-part test. Number one, did Mr. Thomas objectively intend to cause Mrs. Hayes fear? And number two, did Mrs. Hayes objectively experience that fear? And Your Honors, my argument today is number one, objectively, Mr. Thomas had no intent to cause this fear. In fact, his intent was completely the opposite. He was attempting to decipher whether there was still any love, still any feelings in this relationship. Nothing that he did was intended to cause fear. And in the one instance when he was there and he noticed that he may have caused fear, he immediately exited. Your Honors, I see that my time is expiring. May I briefly finish answering your question?
Yes, you can have a few sentences to wrap up.
Thank you. The second part of that, Ms. Hayes reasonably, objectively experiencing that fear. I would cite that clearly Ms. Hayes subjectively experienced that fear, but my argument is based on the context and what was said in those communications, that fear is objectively and reasonably unfounded. Your Honors, in conclusion, Mr. Thomas respectfully asks that the court reverse this case as there were no grounds suggesting harassing conduct that would allow for a harassment restraining order to be issued. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bulett, we'll turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Michael Bulett here on behalf of respondent, Ms. Hayes. Your Honor, the facts here aren't complicated. In August of 2020, these parties broke up. They ended a dating relationship. And after trying to explain to the appellant her decision, respondent sent him a clear message, stop contacting me, in August of 2018. After that message, the appellant sent dozens of texts, 17 emails, 10 gifts or letters, and showed up at her house without invitation. And in his final contact for the harassment restraining order, put in writing in a lengthy letter that he would not stop and would not quit. So Ms. Hayes made use of precisely the remedy that the law allows her and sought a harassment restraining order. Now, most of the law here truly isn't in dispute. We're all working off of 609-748. We're all operating off of the same provision of 609-748, which says that the court was permitted to enter this harassment restraining order if it found one of two things: repeated intrusive unwanted acts that have one of two effects. Either they were intended to have an adverse effect by Mr. Thomas, or they actually did have an adverse effect on Ms. Hayes' safety, security, or privacy. Counsel correctly states in Dunham, this court held that that's an objective standard. So we're not looking to what Mr. Conrad may have felt was normal for this relationship, no more than we're looking to whether Ms. Hayes was either particularly strong or particularly fragile or susceptible to harassment. We look at, in the context of the actions from an objective observer standpoint, were these actions unreasonable and did they have a substantial negative impact on my client's safety, security, or privacy?
Mr. Bulett,
if I can
jump in, because I do think that the next part of this is kind of important. So anytime a district court is making a determination of reasonableness, in my view, that's a comparison between some understanding of what would be reasonable. You compare that to what actually happened, and you determine if the actual conduct in here matches your expectation of reasonableness. The standard of review for determining what actually happened seems pretty clear to me. That's a factual-based standard of review that we would apply. It's that second part that I'm curious about what you think, how you would characterize the determination of what would be reasonable so that you can compare that to what actually happened. That determination of what's reasonable, whether it's in the context of conduct-based attorney's fees or in this context or any context, are we looking at that de novo? Are we looking at that for abuse of discretion? Are we looking at that for some other standard of review? What is the standard that we apply when a district court says, this is what would have been objectively reasonable? And that's what, and then compares that to the facts of the case.
What both Dunham and Cush tell us, Judge Bryan, is that you are always looking at a district court's decision to grant or deny a harassment restraining order for an abuse of discretion. And so that encompassing abuse of discretion standard would apply both to the court's particular findings about what happened here, as well as to the district court's determination of that the conduct was either reasonable or unreasonable with the facts as presented.
Well, I guess this is a bigger question then, because I think that there's, if a district court, for example, makes a legal error, I think we look at that question of law de novo, even though our standard of review language around abuse of discretion says a district court abuses its discretion when it makes findings that are against the evidence, when it makes some legal error as well. So our standard of review language embeds into abuse of discretion both questions of fact and questions of law. But I don't think a district court has any discretion to get the law wrong. I think that that's a legal question that we review de novo. So understanding that we have language out there, and I think that language is really designed for mixed questions, and we rely on that many times in our case law as a way to define what abuse of discretion is, even though we're not looking at a mixed question. So there are times, I think, where you have a pure question of fact. That's clearly erroneous, not abuse of discretion. And a clear question of law, which would be de novo, not abuse of discretion, despite our language that might suggest something contrary. So I come back to the determination of what is reasonable requires some standard of reasonableness that you compare to what actually happened. Determining what that standard is, reasonable judges might disagree what objectively reasonable conduct would look like. What is our standard of review when we're looking at whether the district court erred in setting forth this objective standard that it then compared to the actual facts?
And Your Honor, I would again come back to your standard of review is an abuse of discretion for exactly the reason you pointed out. Different decision makers may find different conduct as a matter of fact, objectively reasonable or objectively unreasonable. And this court's going to examine the district court's findings and conclusions in that extent for an abuse of discretion. So you're absolutely right. Abuse of discretion consists of either an unsupported factual finding or misapplication of the law. So for instance, had this district court said, I agree with appellant, I agree with counsel that objectively speaking, Mr. Thomas's communications don't bother me, but I think they particularly bothered respondent because she was uniquely susceptible. In that instance, it would have misapplied the law. Here, the district court didn't find that. The district court said, I can readily understand why Ms. Hayes felt harassed when in multiple forms and in multiple ways, you continue to contact her and show up at her home after she's told you to stop. And that makes perfect sense to me. So the district court applied that objective standard. And Your Honor, to the extent it's helpful, I'd analogize this to when juries are called upon to determine what a prudent person would have done in a tort context. We understand that to be a question of fact that looks to reasonable minds could disagree around the margins, and we leave that to a finder of fact to determine, based on the facts in front of me, does this appear reasonable? And in this instance, it simply doesn't. And counsel, as Judge Jessen pointed out, goes to lengths to explain to us why, in the context of this relationship, Mr. Thomas felt entitled to continue to communicate, continue to show up, continue to insert himself into the lives of the life of his ex-partner, but his intention isn't what we look to. And this court's decision in Cush makes that very clear. He may have been well-intentioned, and that would not preclude a district court from finding a harassment restraining order was appropriate, because I believe counsel's incorrect when he says this is a two-part conjunctive standard, that the court needed to find both intention objectively and an objective effect. The statute is, in fact, disjunctive. It would be enough for the court to find either that Mr. Thomas intended this effect or that Ms. Hayes, viewed under an objective standard, experienced unwanted impacts on her safety, security, or privacy. And that's what the court found here. Now, there's an attempt, I assume in good faith, to misconstrue the record to a fairly significant degree. And we would point out that both in the statement of the facts of appellant's brief and to a significant degree during oral argument, there's quite a bit of non-record evidence that's being used to support a version of the facts the district court did not find. Perhaps the most extreme example is that Mr. Thomas had no idea until November the 1st that his contacts were unwelcome, he received a letter from his ex-partner that his contacts were unwelcome. Mr. Thomas's testimony said clearly, I knew as of November 1st that there was no hope of reconciliation, and I still kept contacting her. I still kept sending cards, I still kept sending letters, I kept sending online social media messages, and I also sent a multi-page detailed letter that says I'm not gonna stop and I'm not going to quit. We don't need to find today that Mr. Thomas meant to place his former partner in fear, but the reality is that he did. And the district court, looking at this, at all of the facts in this matter, concluded that Ms. Hayes was justified in objectively feeling that this had an adverse effect on her safety, security, and privacy. As you pointed out, Judge Wheelock, at a certain point, the question would become, what is enough? Right? How many times can I send text messages saying, I love you, please take me back, before a court can say, you've been told to stop, it's time to stop. And that's what happened here. Is it unfortunate that Mr. Thomas didn't heed his better judgment and stop when he was asked? It is. And the fact that he didn't and continued to contact his ex-partner permitted the district court, as a matter of its discretion, to enter an order just telling him to stop, telling him to stay away from his former partner and listen to what she told him all the way back in August, which is that she did not want to have any more communication with him. There is a second tier to respond to appellant's brief that I want to touch upon briefly, which are those procedural issues. Substantively, all of the court's findings of fact are supported by the record. The court simply didn't believe Mr. Thomas's version of events. Procedurally, there's some suggestion that evidence wasn't inserted or that the judge exhibited some manner of bias. Neither of those claims carry weight. From a pure appellate procedure standpoint, they carry no water, in part because they weren't preserved below. There was no objection that was sustained such that counsel wasn't permitted to complete testimony. The court was careful to remind us that it wanted us to keep the evidentiary hearing to a half day, and there was absolutely no limitation of either party's presentation of the evidence. As to the claim of judicial bias, again, never raised below. The judicial officer explaining its rooting to both parties was attempting to hearken back to that objective standard that Judge Brian, we've been discussing. Why is it objectively unreasonable to get dozens of communications after you've told someone to stop? Because we hear stories every day about relationships that end and escalate from please take me back, please take me back, to violence. And the court was explaining that decision. It wasn't taking note of evidence outside the proceedings, and it wasn't exhibiting any manner of bias. So because these procedural claims have been forfeited by virtue of not being preserved at the district court, and because they simply don't exhibit any grounds for reversal, on that basis too, the district court should be affirmed. Quite simply, Your Honors, Ms. Hayes had had enough. She'd asked every which way she could to get Mr. Thomas to stop, in writing, by text, through a friend, in person, when he came to her home. And he didn't listen. And so after all of those multiple forms of contact, the district court had to enter an order making that boundary clear for him. There is no abuse of discretion in the district court's findings, and it appropriately applied the law. And for that reason, we'd ask that this court affirm. And unless there are any questions for me, I can conclude.
Doesn't appear there are further questions from the panel. Thank you, Mr. Bulette. Mr. Teff, we'll turn to you for the last word.
You are muted, Mr. Tooft.
I apologize. It would help if you guys could hear me. I'm very sorry about that. Your Honors, sure. In making his decision in district court, Judge Smith made an order from the bench. And in making this order from the bench orally, he stated, "Unfortunately, you know, all you got to do is open the paper, turn the news on. You see those relationships that have gone sour. And the next thing you know, somebody is pulling out a gun and shooting themselves and their lovers." This clearly shows the bias of the district court in this case, as there was no discussion of violence. There was no discussion of guns. Clearly, the judge was pulling in something from either the media, a different case. There has been no discussion in this case of violence and guns, shooting, any of that. And in his discussion in the order, the judge made it clear that that was one of his concerns. Your Honors, our argument is that the court abused its discretion in finding that Mr. Thomas intended to cause fear, and further abused its discretion in finding that Mrs. Hayes objectively felt fear. We're not debating that Mrs. Hayes sent a message to Conrad asking, or Mr. Thomas asking, that the contact stopped. But in the context of this case, that was normal. Mr. Thomas felt entitled to nothing, but he was basing his actions, his contact to Miss Hayes, on the past 2 years of their relationship, in which numerous breakups had occurred. Numerous times, Mr. Thomas had asked Miss Hayes, "It's over, stop contacting me." Mrs. Hayes had asked Mr. Thomas, "We're done. There's no reason to pursue this anymore." And every time, until the final time, they got back together. It is unreasonable now to think that despite this had occurred 4 or 5 times, something was materially different here. That for some reason, Mr. Thomas had all of a sudden intended to cause fear, to cause harm to the woman who he had been dating for 2 years and was still actively interested in romantic.
Mr. Tuft, you keep talking about the intent of the appellant in this case, and I'm curious as to whether, if you look at the district court's order in paragraph 2, where the district court concludes there are reasonable grounds to believe respondent has engaged in harassment, which has or is intended to have. And if you look at the statute, it's one or the other. If you look at Dunham v. Rohr, the first part is either objectively unreasonable conduct or intent. So it seems to me that when you're arguing to us that the district court found he intended to have this effect, I'm not sure that's the only conclusion we can draw from what the district court's conclusion was. And would you agree that we could also conclude the district court found that this conduct had such an adverse effect? Not that he intended it to have, but that it had. And so you're looking at the disjunctive, as Mr. Boulette pointed out.
Your Honor, you are correct. It is an either or standard. It is either the intent or that it actually caused that fear. Either way, Your Honor, it is still subject to the reasonable objective standard.
Right. So let me ask about that, because it seems to me then the disagreement is what is reasonable in the context of this relationship. In other words, if you've had a relationship where it's on and off, it seems to me you're arguing to this court that it's unreasonable for someone in that context to stop communicating when told to stop communicating. And the district court concluded it's reasonable for someone to stop when told to stop. And you disagree with that part of the district court's conclusion. So maybe you can explain why you think it's reasonable for someone not to stop when told to stop communicating.
Your Honor, I would take a different perspective on that. And I would argue that what the district court has to find, not that a person should or should not stop the conduct, but if the conduct and the conduct and the contact reasonably caused the person to experience objective fear. And in this case, Your Honor, what we are arguing is that Mrs. Hayes did not experience reasonable objective fear.
Now, what about the language of the statute that doesn't talk about fear, but talks about a substantial adverse effect on privacy, for example, not just fear?
And your honors, I see that my time has run out. May I briefly respond?
Yes, you may respond to the question.
Thank you. Your honor, to that, I would note it cites to dissemination of private information, assault, or a sexual assault. In this case, there was no dissemination of private information. There was no assault. There was no sexual assault. And if we look back at the standard, the objective reasonable standard, it still requires that Mrs. Hayes's fear or negative feelings were not only subjective, but were reasonably objective. And our argument is that her fear was not reasonably objective, Your Honor.
It appears there are not further questions for the panel. So with that, the court will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within 90 days. We thank you both for the helpful arguments. And with that being the end of our third oral argument, the court is in recess.